You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
Hello out there in archaeology podcast land. This is Dr. Alan Garfinkel. I'm the president and founder of the California Rock Art Foundation. And what we do is we identify, evaluate, manage, and conserve rock art both in Alta California and in Baja California. We conduct field trips, we have trainings, exercise, we do research, and in every way possible, we try to preserve, protect, and coordinate treasures of Alta and Baja California rock art, of which there are many and diverse. We also work closely with Native Americans and partner with them to recognize and protect sacred sites. So for more info about the fabulous California Rock Art Foundation, you can go to carockart.org. Also, I'm open to give me a call, 805-312-2261. We would welcome sponsorship or underwriting, helping us to defray the costs of our podcasts, and also membership in California Rock Art Foundation, and of course, donations, since we are a 501c3 nonprofit scientific and educational corporation. God bless everyone out there in podcast land.
You're listening to the Rock Art Podcast. Join us every week for fascinating tales of rock art, adventure, and archaeology. Find our contact info in the show notes and send us your suggestions.
Hey out there in Rock Art Podcast land. This is your host, Dr. Alan Garfinkel. We're going to be interviewing Michael Adance, who's a rock art cinematographer. And this is going to be such a wild ride. We're going to cover a lot of territory and deal with some thorny issues. And I think you're going to really enjoy this one. Howdy out there in Archaeology Podcast land. This is your host, Dr. Alan Garfinkel, president and founder of the California Rock Art Foundation. And it's one of our regularly scheduled and wonderful rock art podcasts, episode 95. And for this one, be a little bit different. We have a gentleman by the name of Michael Adance. How was that, Michael?
That was great.
Better than nothing, right? we'll cut it out and post.
You sound very Armenian.
Very Armenian, I must tell you. We have to have some stuffed cabbage, Michael. We're going to be talking to Michael about rock art, cinematography, and all things rock art. He is a freelance researcher who's producing a bit of a cinematography, an element, a program on rock art. And with that, I'll introduce you and maybe say a few words, Michael, to our audience. I guess you've heard this. You've listened to the Rock Art Podcast before.
Yeah, I actually just did, today in the morning when you reached out, I tried to listen to a few episodes.
Good. And we met at the Petroglyph Festival in Ridgecrest.
Yes.
And you buttonholed me and said, I need you to, I need some videography, some cinematography here. Can I shadow you? And I said, sure. And I think you went around with me for one of the Petroglyph Park tours, didn't you?
Yes, I did. I did. I went on the tour with a group.
And how did that go?
It was great. You did very well. I thought it was very informative.
You gave me a B+.
I would give you, a strong A-.
A strong A. See, it's on the edge there. And then you asked me to sit down and do some sort of post-tour discussion. Did we have a chance to do that at all or no?
I don't think we got a chance to do that. Well, we had just met that day and I thought it would be nice to just get to know each other because you were mentioning the podcast even back then. And I was sort of saying I could help with that.
Yeah.
And you could maybe help me a little bit with my research. So we just kind of talked.
Give the audience some sort of a glimmer of why in the wide, wide world of everything possible, you chose to do a rock art cinematography project. And what was your motivation and what were you thinking about and what caused you to really focus in on this subject? It's not something that's common.
Yeah, it's definitely not too common. Well, what brought me to the subject originally is the topic of portable rock art, which is sort of like a niche.
Portable rock art.
I know there's a term called portable art, which is an actually, a scientific archaeological term. But there's kind of a French term called portable rock art, and it comes from very much from like the amateur field in archaeology, where basically people are all over the world, including, you know, the States, North America, you know, claim to find rocks that they claim to be artifacts made by the natives of the area, ancient artifacts. And the thing about them is, you know, you kind of really have to read into their interpretation of these quote unquote artifacts to see what they're seeing in it. So there are cases where you can kind of see faces or face figures, which, you know, in the movement, sort of say, is called like face stones. And then there are a lot of bird figure interpretations. So I got kind of into this, you know, sort of a YouTube hole, you could say, about this topic. And I saw some research about it.
Hey, Michael, I know a bit about portable rock art. I have a colleague who actually graduated with a PhD about the time I was entering UC Davis. And his name is David Hurst Thomas. Do you know him?
I do not.
He's the director of prehistory at the American Museum of Natural History in New York. And he's recently put together an article on the portable rock art of the entire Great Basin. He had had me look at it and review that article before it appeared in American Antiquity. He's considered one of the most prestigious and scholarly archaeologists and has done very little in the way of work in rock art. And I was very, very surprised to read and see what he had to say about portable rock art. I think what got him very interested in it is he had excavated a cave in the Great Basin, a dry cave. In that Great Basin environment, he found literally hundreds and hundreds of portable rock art artifacts. And so...
Wow, that's very interesting.
Yeah, he decided to take it on his shoulders to collect and identify and inventory and assess all those objects that he was aware of or that had been published on portable rock art throughout the entire Great Basin. And I had read in advance rather deeply and had always been interested in this portable rock art per se for a variety of reasons. I just wanted to seed our conversation mentioning this. And as this conversation moves, we'll see if any of the ideas or things that I have in mind would play well with your research.
Yeah, that's very fascinating. And it's interesting that you say that, you know, the site where he found a large quantity of sort of portable rock art pieces.
It was in a single cave, a rock shelter. And if you look in the entire Great Basin, the Desert West, there's literally thousands and thousands of these portable rock art artifacts. They're made of slate or of some either green, brown, or gray, and they're scratched, usually on one side or both sides. Does any of that make any sense?
Yes, it does. Definitely. You know, it's interesting that it's in a cave, because as far as I understand, it is easier to tell whether or not an artifact is indeed an artifact if it's found in a cave, because, you know, the cave itself can be researched, whether or not these types of stones are present there. So that's a unique case. And I know one of the most recognized pieces of portable rock art, I think I mentioned to you when we met, was the, and I'm probably going to mispronounce it, so I'll have to repeat it, but it's the Makapansgat pebble.
Yes.
Which was found in South Africa in a cave where there were bones of Australopithecuses, also found at the same cave. And the type of rock or mineral that this pebble is made out of is not present anywhere near that area inside the cave, around the cave. So archaeologists sort of, you know, proclaimed that this was something that ancient people, around 3 million years ago, recognized something, you know, totemic or some type of recognition of its facial features, and brought with them to the cave.
I'm also familiar with this artifact you're talking about. It's interesting because there's a gentleman on the East Coast who was very, very interested in that artifact. And he wrote research designs, trying to get funded to visit, I guess, the curation facility where that artifact is found. Did you connect with him at all? Do you know who he is?
I'm not sure. No, I haven't really mentioned or talked to anyone about the pebble itself.
Yeah.
I just know that it is a popular example.
He was specifically interested in that pebble, in that particular artifact, and doing further research on it or on comparable artifacts as well. He wrote a whole series of research designs and particular analytical studies that he wanted to do on that particular artifact. But his project, unfortunately, was never deemed successful nor funded by National Geographic. But I think he was introduced to me from the gentleman who does the that journal called Rock Art Research. You had mentioned him. His name is Bednarik, Robert Bednarik. And Robert is one of the most, I think, influential and prestigious rock art researchers in the world. So I attended one of the conferences that the International Organization for Rock Art and Rock Art Research itself out of Australia had in New Mexico. And that's how I met a number of these researchers from all over the world. That was quite an amazing experience. So, Michael, I don't mean to monopolize the time, but please go on. I'm intrigued.
No, of course, that does sound very interesting. I'm sure, you know, so many researchers have such unique expertise in the field. So, you know, I'm sure you can learn a lot. But was the person by any chance that you were mentioning about the pebble named Raymond A. Dart? Because
no.
He wrote this article that I read, but it's from 1974 from the South African Journal of Science. That's the most detailed article that I read about the pebble itself.
Interesting. Yeah. No, he's another individual. He is a professor on the East Coast, and I'll research him and get you his name. But he's been mostly interested in cognitive neuroscience, and he's commented on various articles that appeared in the IFRAO, the International Federation of Rock Art Organizations. That is and their journal is called Rock Art Research. And that's the one that I've mentioned this to you on our independent telephone conversation, that I had been published three different times in various articles that I had written, because that is the most widely read and the most, I think, one of the more difficult journals to have your research appear. It's now published both in color. It's in color now, and they do a fantastic job. It only appears twice a year.
So the researcher you mentioned, Robert G. Bednarik, I'm sure he would be familiar with all these topics that we're discussing. And, you know, it took me about like 10 minutes of being on Google and researching rock art to, you know, come by his name and sort of see his extensive publication record. And I bought one of his books and read it, called Myths About Rock Art. You know, he definitely does not stand by a lot of the mainstream theories in archaeology. I know he is very into the domestication theory of sort of human evolution.
Yes, yeah.
He's not a big fan of the Africa First theory. And in terms of the rock art, the Myths About Rock Art book, you know, taught me a lot just in terms of how, you know, open-ended the research can be, some of the problems in the field, some of the experiments that proved how an outsider of a certain culture can hardly sometimes interpret rock art pieces.
Definitely. I think we should cut it off about there. Because I think we'll have a lot to say. We've not really tackled some of the questions that you and I began to discuss on the phone, but I think this might be a wonderful venue to do that. See you on the flip-flop, gang. More to come. Welcome back for all you fans of the Rock Art Podcast. We have Michael Adans here with us. He's a rock art cinematographer creating a documentary film on the subject of rock art, which he's going to tell us a bit more about. And as we discussed, it opens up a lot of issues involving the study of rock art, some of the theories, the methodologies, the various models and perspectives that various researchers have on the study of rock art. So take it away, Michael. Open the can of worms for us. How's that?
Yes. So, Alan, so, you know, in my very limited research about rock art, I've discovered some, you know, controversies about interpretations, and specifically talking about an Australian experiment conducted by Dr. McIntosh in the 50s, where he had a certain interpretation of various anthropomorphic pieces in the Northern Territory in Australia. Later on, he was able to find a member of that culture, an indigenous member of the culture that was highly initiated in their tradition and actually knew exactly what the pieces that McIntosh had been studying for somewhat of a, like around a decade, I think, meant. And basically, it turned out that 90% of McIntosh's interpretation of these pieces was incorrect, and initiated a member of that culture was able to sort of dispute it or, you know, give the actual correct interpretation. So, you know, I bring this up to kind of begin the discussion with you about some of the issues that can arise when an outsider of a culture is interpreting rock art, and whether or not we're even able to do that, you know, if we're not an insider and have been sort of raised by the ways of a certain culture, can we even understand what the art represents?
Yeah, I think you're right on the money. And I think that Bednarik's cautious note, his caveats, are valid. And it's unfortunate that Robert has taken such an extreme stance, very extreme. You know, there's different perspectives on rock art, and one of those that I find the most grievous or difficult to deal with are some of my colleagues who are very well known in the field of rock art and have published some of the key articles about rock art, and even those in my own research area. And when they talked to me about it, they said, "Well, Alan, it's only rock art. You can say whatever you want to say about it." And that's definitely an incorrect assessment. I believe that the key to rock art understanding is to get as close to you can as an insider's view. You need to dig deep in the ethnography and the anthropology and also the indigenous perspective on rock art and on the, I would call it the theology, the religious perspective, the cosmological nexus, and also understand some of the neurophysiological elements of all this, the cognitive neuroscience, and also the embedded understanding of symbols. It's called semiotics. We've had people on here talking about semiotics as well. And using all the different threads and data sets that we can simultaneously, we're certainly never going to get to an incontrovertible, you know, ultimately factual reading of rock art. But that being said, we can get to a level where we ask informed questions, we gather data, and we get some sort of a superficial, if not sometimes rather deep, understanding of the meanings, the intent, the stories, and all the various elements, the cosmological elements, the sort of package of compound meanings that are embedded in just a single panel or even a single element of rock art. And I would argue that sometimes we're lucky, and sometimes we can talk to Native people where they tell us what various elements of a rock art panel mean to them. And when we get to that level, that's sort of an it's called emic understanding of the images and symbolism and the packages of understanding, the compound metaphors that are embedded in these panels. You wouldn't think that looking at a panel of rock art would be so difficult to understand, but it is. It takes decades and decades of study, and then drilling down into the ethnographic record, and also drilling down into knowing everything you possibly can about the various facets of what we're studying. It takes an understanding of theology, of neuroscience, neurophysiology. It takes an understanding of the animal behavior, the habits and habitats of the animals being represented. It has to do with language and linguistic prehistory and comparative linguistics. I could go on and on and on, but the number of layers of meaning and information that one needs to do a good job of deconstructing rock art is rather overwhelming to most people. So most people most scholars and most academicians would never attempt it, but occasionally we do. And when we do, sometimes little bits of treasure there, and we get a glimmer of the actual meaning of what those images meant to those people that lived hundreds and sometimes thousands of years ago. So that's what I think on that one. And I guess Robert Bednarik, even though he takes a very extreme view, an alternative view, an alternative platform, explanatory platform of looking at rock art, there must be a hint in him of some of the alternative ways of thinking about rock art, because he's published three of my articles. And they certainly have a good dose of this symbolic metaphor and an ethnographic understanding of what these images mean. So how does that hit you, Michael?
That hits me very well. Definitely, you know, I think he, as a person who studied rock art for his, you know, for the majority of his professional career, I'm sure Bednarik is still very interested and believes in researching the topic. But I do see his point about basically that there's a lot of deadwood at the, you know, base of the subject and of the research that needs to be sort of burned off, and a lot of the interpretations and meanings maybe reconsidered.
I like that. So the only caveat I have is don't throw out the baby with the bathwater.
No, yeah, definitely don't do that. And
one of the most cutting edge examples of good interpretation, right, is Carolyn Boyd's book on the White Shaman, the Pecos tradition. And she does the deconstruction and the ethnographic work and the semiotics that I'm talking about all in one. And it actually won the award for the best new volume in the Society for American Archaeology back in, I believe, was 2020. So I think that rock art has, in some ways, hit its stride. Not that it has a long ways to go, but, and as you tell me, and as I know very well, we've come a little ways, but we have a very, very long ways to go.
Yeah, I think it definitely fascinates people one way or the other. Like, the way I think about it is, of course, it's a very sensitive topic. It's something that needs to be very much respected, and the members of the cultures that are being studied, that are present today, you know, the research approach needs to involve them and involve.
Yes, absolutely. That's, you know, that's one of the,
somehow
I'd say one of the newest and cutting.
Yes.
And that's one of the other, you know, theoretical battles we're having, is how to bring Native Americans into the fore and integrate them in our research.
Absolutely.
And we do that, but not very well. Go ahead.
And it's something that is hard to do well, because, you know, like you were saying, there's so many, you know, if you find a rock art painting, you might think that, you know, a couple hours of analysis might bring a good interpretation. But in reality, like, the things that archaeologists need to do to even try to get the right dating or any sorts of a right interpretation. Yeah, it's like chemistry is involved, like history, animal behavior. You're absolutely right. It becomes like probably one of the vastest fields in all of academia, because there's absolutely no context. Yeah, you know, if you're studying a Renaissance painting, there's a ton of context, you know, the whole schools, the whole historiography that is very well detailed. But here, all you have is, you know, the place, and you got to study the place and the history of the place and the geology. So it becomes very overwhelming. And I see how somebody who's into archaeology and never thought that they would ever have to study something like geology or animals or radiocarbon dating, you know, they just don't want to do that. But that's in reality what you sort of have to look into to get as many details as possible.
But to pay respect to one of our themes, and I've mentioned this to you, I think, and others, is that I spent 40 years studying the rock art of Eastern California, paintings, petroglyphs, etc. But in 4 years of working on that book called the Handbook of the Kawaiisu, who are an indigenous group that live in that area, and trying to do a synthetic study summarizing what we know about rock art, ethnology, archaeology, contemporary activities of the native group, linguistics, basketry, you name it, sort of a soup to nuts anthology. I learned more from working directly with the native people and providing me with their insights and wisdom than I did in the total 40 years. It opened up my mind and dismantled my structure of knowing. One of the biggest data sets that is ignored consistently by archaeologists is oral tradition, or I call it sacred narrative. And it's also given the name mythology that I don't like. But by studying the creation stories and the sacred narratives and probing deeply into the structure of those stories, their subject matter, and the nature of those, the images, the animals, the activities that are being conducted, they're often sometimes a roadmap to understanding rock art, because there's this theology, there's ritual, there's mythology, there's ceremony, and they're all interwoven so closely together in this fabric of another ontology, another way of seeing and understanding the world. And you might have something to say about any of that.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's one of the most fascinating parts about rock art, just how much it can teach us about the depth of the human mind. I think it's fascinating to see how a modern day person interprets a piece and then learn, you know, the reality of what's behind it and just how far off it can be and how niche and foreign ancient mythology can be. And it's kind of what Ben Darnig said. It's almost like the indigenous people possess a software that we lack to be able to analyze.
And I would agree wholeheartedly with that. Yes, yeah. That's exactly right. There's very few papers that I've read that really approach that question of sort of the differences in software, the difference of the cognitive nature of the universe that is gathered by native people versus the Western industrial concept. But I'm tackling that from a number of different angles lately, which is rather amazing. So where do we go from here, Michael? What is your ethnic background, or what is your historical background for dealing with all this? I know that when I met you, I detected an accent.
I think we spoke a little bit about the Khachkars, that is sort of the native Armenian art practice.
Mm-hmm.
You know, not to say that, you know, I know a lot about them, but as far as stone-based art goes, culturally, Armenians are actually masters of it, some of the more modern masters of it, because, you know, a lot of other cultures moved away from working with stone, but Armenian Christians were so fascinated with stone weaving and creating stone churches. But, you know, my background is I'm Armenian. I grew up in Russia, and then I moved to the States when I was in my early teens. And, you know, I've always been fascinated by cinema and film, you know, but history is also very much interested me. And I just wanted to sort of combine the two. And I just felt that there was no real resource that captures just how open to interpretation our human past is.
I see where you're going with this. I like it. No, I like it. Because I did a film with an Emmy and Oscar winning cinematographer. And we worked 4 years on it. And I don't think you've seen it yet. It's called Talking Stone. One of the critiques was, you didn't answer the questions, Alan. you know, because my cinematographer editor who voices over the whole thing says, you know, I'll end it like this. Is it began as an enigma or a mystery. It ends with a mystery. And we had a half a dozen different people try to explain it. And maybe the push and pull is the mystery. That's the connection that people have with this data set. And with that, I'll take another break and see you on the flip-flop, gang. So we're back out there in archaeology podcast land. This is your host, Dr. Alan Garfinkel, on the Rock Art Podcast. We're at episode 95 with a remarkable cinematographer who hails from a lot of different regions, exotic to the United States. And he's taken it upon his responsibilities to do something with rock art in his cinematography artistic way. Michael, so we got into it there and pretty deeply, didn't we?
We got into it, definitely. You know, while we're on this subject of cinematography, I just wanted to bring up that it is hard to make rock art interesting on film, I would say. Surprisingly, shooting rocks can be a little bit difficult in terms of, you know, like fascinating your viewer.
Paul Goldsmith said that it was the most difficult project he's ever had doing this talking stone, because how do you make the rocks dance and sing?
No, absolutely. And there's stuff you can try like de-stretch, which kind of makes things a little more visible and colorful. But, you know, and the other problem is what you brought up before the break, which is, you know, you start with the mystery, you end with the mystery, which is just not sort of the film way, the Hollywood way of telling a story. You know, you want to have answers.
You want to have conclusions. Then, yeah.
And then to tell people, no, actually we know what it is. It's this. And we just, you know, told you all, but
exactly. Beginning, a middle and an end, it's got to evolve and it's got to have emotions and dance and sing and pull you in and give you a tug. So all of that has to be done. So Michael, in your adventure on developing this cinematic wunderkind in rock art, what has been your most interesting or exciting discovery so far?
Well, we can circle back to the topic of portable rock art, just because I kind of want to bring people's attention to it. There's, you know, a fringe movement basically happening online, where amateur archaeologists find rocks in areas that they claim to be artifacts. And there are, you know, thousands of videos about this on YouTube from different channels, different individuals from different regions. Many of them talk to each other, sort of share information, share posts. There, if you go on eBay and, you know, type in portable rock art, you'll get like a bunch of stones that are being sold for like thousands of dollars that I don't think anyone's buying. But, you know, it just became a weird thing that I discovered. There's a portable rock art museum.
What? Come on.
Which is
really?
which is like a website. I don't know if it's a physical museum, but if you look it up, if you literally just go on Google and look up portable rock art museum, it'll take you there, and they have an enormous amount of research, photos, and they quote. And this is the website where I first learned about Robert G. Bendarnik, because they quote him a lot and, list some of his articles. And it is a very sort of out there thing. I actually ended up, so when I first got into this and I first found my first YouTube channel about portable rock art, I didn't even know about, you know, anything about archaeology, basically. I just thought that this gentleman has been finding real artifacts that he's been sharing online for us to see, and that, you know, given with some time, you know, someone's going to discover these videos on YouTube and take up all his collection and put it in the museum or something like that. Like, it, you know, some of the pieces that he originally was posting were very much like, I could recognize the face stones that he was talking about. Like, I could, I sort of was on board. And then I've learned that, oh no, this is actually a very argued about topic, and this is not certain, and this is sort of like just his interpretation. So I ended up visiting this gentleman. He lives in North Carolina, and he took me to the site where he's been finding his quote-unquote artifacts and some of his home collection, and we talked a lot about it. And you know, this is a person who's not an archaeologist by any sense of the word, but they're sort of successful in their own field. They definitely don't need like any type of like, you know, exposure, or they're not really like looking for fame or something like that. So this just kind of like overtook their life though, you know, so it just became like the biggest topic, and their whole house is full of rocks, and they make a lot of videos on YouTube and have sort of a grown community. and there are a lot of people like this online.
So what is your assessment of the integrity, validity, utility of this particular adventure in rock art?
So when we went around, there were, you know, some of the pieces that he would show me, I would really need to sort of like listen to his interpretation and try to see it from his eyes to understand sort of how he that was started. But, you know, at the Ridgecraft Festival, I learned a little bit about what it takes to work with stone. And I talked to a flint knapper there and sort of our discussion and stuff. So I kind of tried to see if any of the stones were worked on, you know, something that had evidence of like napping or something like that. And there were definitely a couple pieces that he showed me that it's hard to argue that they weren't modified, you know, that they were natural pieces. And there are very few of these pieces that are very like very hard to argue that they're not modified out of his vast collection. But the fact that they all come from the same place, you know, it sort of comes, you know, becomes a thing where, well, these pieces, I do see how these could be artifacts. So does that mean that the rest of the pieces, like, does that prove the integrity of their validity more, you know?
Give them validity and authenticity. Yeah. Well, yes. Michael, you're teaching me something because I never heard of anything about this before. I didn't know there was this huge camp of people that are passionately interested in portable rock art artifacts. that look like various beings or pictures or animals or people or whatever. I did not know that. Yes, I think I've seen them once in a while. People may have sent me something and I've told them, no, that's really not anything. But there must be a camp of people that obviously believe there's some validity to this. There's a concept called pareidolia, and you know about that, right? Where people...
Oh, yeah. They hate when you talk about stuff.
I know. They're going to go nuts now.
Yeah. That's when they start rolling their eyes and stop listening.
Right. Because immediately I know that if I look at the ground, I can pick up pictures of people and animals, and you stare at clouds and the sky and all the above. But it is far and few that we find actual artifacts, portable artifacts, especially, that are fashioned into forms that are comparable to things we see in the natural world. The Chumash were famous for that, and they had artifacts made of soapstone where they replicated various sea creatures, be they fish or sea mammals. But even those were subject to some interesting dynamics, political dynamics, where an individual got involved with it and decided to make some of those for himself and sell them as authentic. And he got away with it and made himself a pretty penny. So this was way down at the turn of the century, early 1900s, that all of this went down. And I believe there's an article in the Journal of California and Great Basin Anthropology. Robert Heiser. Yeah, exactly. Please.
I mean, fraud in archaeology, there are a couple of famous examples. And I think ultimately, like, the portable rock art movement suffers from various maladies. And the number one malady is the fact that, you know,
no one takes them serious.
No one takes them seriously, and because no one takes them seriously, they don't take professional archaeologists seriously, which is an issue. And they will be the first ones to tell you how many issues professional archaeology possesses, but at the same time, you know, they use all these arguments against it to just prove that they're the ones right, you know, and that their interpretations are correct and that everyone should take them seriously and make them famous and, you know, give them money or something like that. Not to say that all of them are like that. There are a lot of, you know, more of like, for a lack of a better word, like, or like more like hippie people, you know, who are really into rocks and they really see things in them and they just want to share, you know, their love for it and they love their love for their quote unquote artifacts and kind of bring people's attention to that. You know, it's a very vast thing and it's actually been present. I can send you an article, but the discussions about this have been going on in American archaeology since at least the 60s from my research. That's the earliest that I've been able to find mentions of portable rock art.
I think this could be a fabulous movie, let me tell you, because it will capture or sort of deal with one of those, call it fringe movement or some sort of an unusual movement of people that are passionate about a subject that is highly controversial and some would say completely fraudulent. So anyways, there's all of that. Well, Michael, I think we've got the perfect sort of bow on the package for this one. Part of what we're dealing with here is an alternative sense of reality. It's another cognitive sort of realm. Native people believe that rocks, water, plants, sky, everything is sentient and has agency. It's alive and has a knowledge and makes choices. And in fact, physicists are beginning to believe that there's quite a bit to that particular perspective. And I think that some of us have alternative ways of seeing the world, and they can get a glimpse of what those rocks may be telling us about who they are, what they are, and what they're intending to communicate. Does that make any sense to you?
Yeah, definitely. And I think we even see that today. I mean, look how many people today are into crystals and you know, all sorts of stone conventions, even forget the portable rock art topic. We, you know, in LA, they're like, you know, huge conventions where people just come around and talk about rocks, talk about stones, minerals.
Well, Michael, you gave me the greatest ending. We're talking about quartz crystals or even the white milky quartz. Scientists have told us that those are particular stones that have life in them. They have a thing called triboluminescence or piezoelectricity properties that if you pound them together, they turn red and have a red fire inside of them. And they actually transmit and are used in electronics as a means of conveying a particular set of electronic sound bites. And so we have a meeting of the minds where the native people were aware of the sentient qualities, the agency, the aliveness of these items. And physicists, scientists have demonstrated that, yes, indeed, they are alive and they transmit energy. So by transmitting energy, that's exactly what we're after. So with that, I think we'll close it off. Michael, you want to say a few words to end it?
Yeah, just, you know, I just think that amateur archaeology and professional archaeology have intertwined histories. And oftentimes things that came from the fringes ended up becoming accepted by the mainstream, but often not. So I think everyone just has to keep an open mind and, you know, be able to really do scientific research and scientific work and prove their points with good arguments. So I just hope that the portable rock art movement is able to find some plausible solutions to the problems that it's presenting.
Michael, it's been a pleasure to have you on board. I didn't realize I was going to get into it this deeply or this at this level of controversy and bring in so many different tangents. I think this has been one of the more interesting mosaics that we have woven into one of our podcasts. God bless you, Michael. Thank you for your participation. See you next week, gang.
Thanks for listening to the Rock Art Podcast with Dr. Alan Garfinkel and Chris Webster. Find show notes and contact information at www.arcpodnet.com/rockart. Thanks for listening, and thanks for sharing this podcast with your family and friends. This episode was produced by Chris Webster from his RV traveling the United States, Tristan Boyle in Scotland, DigTech LLC, Cultural Media, and the Archaeology Podcast Network, and was edited by Chris Webster.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.